Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the War Report. If you were on the line when the show first came on, you heard this particular version of one of our theme songs here, Smiling Faces. That's kind of what today's show is about at some level. As you know, the show, if you get our promotion, we're going to talk about teachers as conscious leaders, but we're also going to talk about the unions in general, and particularly teachers' union. And so that's Smiling Faces. Keep that in mind as we go on today. Hopefully you may begin to see both my humor and my anger from selecting that intro song today, which, you know, we play it often, but particularly for today. We have a guest today who has been on the War Report many times in the past. Some of you already know him. You may know him through his blogging, and he is a terrific, terrific young person. I guess almost anybody I have on the show is a young person to me, and I'm going to let him introduce himself, but I want to say this going into the show and into Brian. Brian and I have been Facebook friends, colleagues, for most of the time that I've been on the air, which will be 3 years, going into the fourth year this coming February. Brian is, in my view, one of the most, sophisticated and knowledgeable teacher person that I've had the pleasure to meet since I started War Report, and I think maybe you will see some of that today. Also, Brian and I talk frequently. When I'm in California, when I'm on the road, or what have you, we email, we do all kinds of things. And I have a tremendous, tremendous respect for Brian's values, his attitudes, but his scholarship is off the chart as far as I'm concerned. And I want to say this going forward, as I always do in the area of full disclosure, I am one of the proud, very proud people to be able to say that I'm Brian's mentor in this particular area, and we have a fantastic mentor-mentee relationship. We clash, we do all kinds of things, but at the end of the day, we are best buds and colleagues in this war on public education. With that, I'm going to introduce Brian. Brian, don't get a fat head because I was being nice to you. That's when the show is over. I'll go back to me being you. And so, anyway, with that, folks, here's Brian.
How are you doing, Dr. Miller? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Why don't you give a more extensive bio on yourself?
Sure. I graduated from St. Mary's College in Moraga, California, with a degree in political science. I minored in women's studies. I have a teaching credential in social science. I also have a teaching credential in special education, focusing on mild to moderate students. I'm currently doing my master's in special education on language in the pre-referral for the special education process. Also, I'll be looking into PhD programs starting in January. I started teaching in 1999. I've been a union stop steward, served for about 7 years, been an area vice president, in my teachers' union. I've helped folks with labor problems, unfair labor practices, and things of that nature, and have had actually very good success. I network with teachers in New York, as well as Florida, and obviously California, where I'm based. And I have friends in Washington, D.C. who, you know, work in Democratic Party circles who you know, like me, are disappointed with what's been going on, but they do keep me informed, so I'm always in the loop, and I kind of on the cutting edge of what's going on, so that's a good thing. So that is basically my bio.
Okay. Let's start with, for those of you who get our War Report, or you come to our Facebook page, War Report, you got our promotion, and you know that the title of the show is Teachers as Conscious Leaders. And some of the things that we're going to talk about, and there are a lot of them, Brian, getting ready for the show, I don't know whether or not we're going to be able to do justice to all of these. So keep in mind, you and I may do a second show on this.
Sure.
Because this is most timely and very important, and I want to give it the time that it needs. Okay. Let's start out with, you said, and the state of our country as it relates to the post-election and the state of our unions. Let's start with that.
Well, sure, absolutely. Well, we can start in the macro and work our way in as far as income disparity, the share of the top 10% of income vis-a-vis the bottom 90% hasn't been this bad since 1931. It's the last time the top 10% had this much share of income. Again, compared to industrialized countries, Western countries, the income disparity in America is worse than any other country. If you look at the labor force participation rate, that is the percentage of eligibility of workers who are actually working, it's, you know, at a peak of 67% in 1998. That's down to 63% in 2016, which is 18 more or less consecutive years of decline. If you look at number of people on food stamps, and I want to make a pertinent caveat here, I'm not against food stamps. They're very important. People need them, but the number of people on food stamps is over 40 million Americans. And most on record in history, the U3 unemployment, for those who don't know what the U3 is, it's people who either are working or recently laid off on unemployment less than 6 months. They officially rate that at 5.1%. The U6 includes people working part-time, but they can't find a full-time job. That's up closer to 11%. But when you throw in discouraged workers, people who have given up looking for work, and we're going to the pre-1994 Bill Clinton metrics, that is, Bill Clinton removed discouraged workers from the methodology of unemployment, real unemployment rate is closer to 22.8%. And those factors largely, I believe, is what propelled Trump to the presidency. I think that under the surface, there was an understanding and a lot of, we're going to call it quiet dissent by your, you know, more liberal academics, such as Robert Reich at Cal Berkeley, former Clinton Secretary of Labor, people like Laura Tyson, Christina Romer, who served with Obama on his Council of Economic Advisors before they resigned, obviously. They didn't stay that long, obviously. But I think the raw economic disparity, particularly in the Rust Belt in the South, is what led to the Trump presidency. And obviously on the show, we're going to talk about how that directly relates to unionism or lack of unionism.
Well, let's go to that, because I have something that I want to try and contribute once you talk about what you just said in terms of that's the macro, the big picture level. Now taking it down to the union.
Yes.
Remember, and you and I have had this discussion before, and I think I've even mentioned it on the show, that the unions have always had a very difficult time trying to get started and to sustain itself in a hostile country like the U.S. has always been towards unions. The fear the fear that the capitalist class always had toward union. And what unions represent basically is a collectivity. It's one thing for a huge corporation to go up against one individual at a time, either as an employee or as a would-be citizen, but it's something entirely different when that entity has to go up against 100, 1,000, 1,000,000. It's incredibly different, but it's also incredibly threatening. So unions have had a tough going period. There have been different periods of time when individuals joined in collectives, and of course there have been efforts to crush them, et cetera. But in, say, the modern day, and I'm going to say the modern day is the 1950s, latter part of the 40s, into the 50s and 60s, when unions finally started to get a foothold in the late 1950s, the automobile union, and then, of course, the teachers union coming out of New York. That's part of what you're talking about when you say the unions.
Yes.
So we're going to try and bring it from the big picture down to the middle picture in terms of unions and then down to the teachers' unions. Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we can go just quickly. We'll just do three states. I have a graphic in front of me. We'll do California, New York, and Florida. 1964, 33% of households were in a union in California. 1964, 35.5% household unions in New York. 1964, 14% household unions in Florida. We fast forward to 2014. As of 2 years ago, California's down to 16.6% union households. Okay? New York is down to 24.6%. And Florida has been crushed down to 5.7%. So you can see a qualitative actual metric here. When you have the decline of unions, you have the decline of lower and middle income, and therefore you have the upward mobility of the top 1% on total income. So there is an absolute qualitative metric we can see here. It's always been true that strong unions, particularly teachers' unions, have always not only educated the next generation, but they've created a middle class that can sustain itself. And actually, that middle class would have actual voting power in the voting booth for policies that are in their interest. And, of course, that is the end result that you want. But as you can see, we've gone backwards. We're going back, you know, just going back to LBJ when you're talking about that. We've gone backwards pretty much every single year since.
Well, keep in mind, first of all, you talk a quantitative versus qualitative picture here. We're talking in terms of quantitative statistics.
Yeah.
And also keep in mind that what I said just a moment ago in terms of the unions have been scorned so much. The unions are socialists, unions are communists, unions whatever, so that the working class, the people that Trump, I guess, resonated with in the areas in which they voted so significantly are areas where people are against unions.
That's correct.
At the rank-and-file level, at the household level, at the individual level, even though unions, as you were trying to point out, in those areas where you have had unions in the past, there has been a qualitative as well as a qualitative indications that unions and being part of a union leads to higher income, leads to benefit packages that can impact your health. It leads to your ability to send your kids to college, this generational mobility, and with the growth of the unions, and with the, especially at its high point, then let's go back to the big picture, the automobile industry, and then the city, county, state workers, when they unionize, and then other industries, when they unionize. You had millions across the country who were in a union. So, yes, they did impact the local, county, state, and federal political structure. They did impact the economic base of the country at all those levels.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a very short-lived influence impact, because there's always been a continued effort to crush the union, to vilify the unions, and to vilify those individuals who are in unions, especially union leadership. So
yes.
That you see what I'm just more or less reframing something that you just said, in that you can see where large union membership could have an impact on the entire country's economic and what we now talk about in neoliberalism, the political economy.
Yes.
Tremendous impact there. Continue.
Yes, absolutely. Right. But just as we go forward with this chronology, what has happened, and I'm going to hone it down to the teachers' union specifically. I got this right off the AFT website with Randy Weingarten. She says, sustaining union management partnerships is not easy, but nothing worth doing is ever. Such work requires that educators and administrators communicate with each other, trust each other, and respect each other as professionals they are. Those who are serious about improving schools recognize that conflict is a destructive force, especially in the lives of children, Weingarten wrote. Indeed, in many years as a teacher and union leader, I've never seen a district that produces great results for students in an adversarial, us versus them environment. And mass firing, school closures, and attacks on teachers are not the formula for successful schools. And the reason I wanted to highlight that quote is because under Randy Weingarten's watch, we've had mass firings, school closures, and attacks on teachers, bullying, such and such and such and such, to the point now in my state in California, young people don't want to go into teaching. But it is not the teachers that are perpetuating the conflict. The conflict is being perpetuated by management. Yet at the same time, Randy Weingarten tells us, I'm a member of AFT and NEA, she tells us that we need to have labor-management collaboration, and that the interests of labor and management are one and the same. And you and I know labor history. They are polar opposites. And so it is the fundamental betrayal of the teachers' unions, okay, in my view, and I think I can back this up with quantitative data and qualitative data, that has led to the demise of the middle class. For example, now the Democrats have lost something like two-thirds of all the state legislatures and state houses. The Democrats have lost something like 30 out of 50 governorships, okay? When you throw in the gerrymandering of lines and voting, it will be worse. So under the leadership of Randy Weingarten, and we also have Lilly, teachers' union health care has gotten more expensive. Some cases under Obamacare has gotten better, but generally speaking, the health care costs have not gone down. And the salaries are to the such that, you know, you have a lot of turnover and teachers aren't staying in the profession. So I think that you can see, as long as the union attitude is that managers and teachers have the same goals, while at the same time teachers are under attack on a daily basis by management, and the cost has shifted from administrator salaries, principal salaries, deputy superintendent salaries, the superintendent of Oakland, next city next to mine, is in the paper yesterday. He's making $400,000 a year. So they have basically transferred the income to management, and teachers have lost out every single year. And I think that is where the issue with teachers' unions. So I want to be very clear. I am not anti-union, not by any stretch. However, unions that don't enforce their collective bargaining contracts, do not enforce their state labor laws, their state ed codes and statutes, do not represent their members. That is the issue that we have to deal with in a serious way. And the good news now, after this shellacking that the Democrats took, I mean, particularly in the red states, I know Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but losing the House, Senate, presidency, and teachers under increased attack. Now is the time I think we can actually have clear battle lines.
Let me hone in on something that you said.
When you said
Randy is saying that where we've had conflict, it has not helped us, and said what we should streak. I say we because I'm a teacher. Once you're a teacher, you're always a teacher. I have been my entire life one of the strongest unionists there is because my family's life was totally impacted in 1959 when we got the contract. It changed everything for us. So I am a diehard unionist. But Randy was saying the conflict and that teachers, unions should have this spirit of cooperation versus conflict. And you question that. What I'm going to correct you is she meant exactly what she said. The union should cooperate with management representing the other side. And she's done a hell of a job at that. She has cooperated her ass off. And the results are right there for everyone to see what cooperating with the other side has done to both the teacher's profession and to public education. But something you didn't say,
I'm listening.
That was the past up to yesterday, but today going forward, she's still pushing that same line.
Yeah, and I was going to get to that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take your thunder.
No, it's okay. The first day after the election, I tweeted to her that you should resign. You failed. I just was very clear. You should resign. And elections have consequences. In my view, you know, you are trusted with millions of teachers for their economic and professional well-being, and yet all I see is obviously you're taking the teachers' money, and the teachers are showing up and doing exactly what Randy says, and they're not getting anywhere, to the point where in every state you have teacher shortages. And you know how this works. If you have a shortage in an industry, particularly teaching, which is always going to be needed, that means that the grandmother is telling the daughter, who's telling the granddaughter, who was forced out of her job early, who was forced to retire early, who has symptoms of PTSD and all other physical ailments, the literally hundreds of teachers I talked to the last 2 years who are unable to work because they've been bullied out of their jobs, okay? That has deroded and eroded the profession, which is also a bad thing. So now you have a shortage in an important profession that you can't fill. So now the quality of teachers that you're getting is, okay, you don't need a bachelor's degree. You don't need a credential. You don't need to be certified. Next thing you know, all you need is an AA degree. And when you have, as you know, less education, you can't justify and get the salary up. So what Randy has done effectively, I think, is basically educational treason. I'll just say it's treason. And the fact that, again, this morning, it was this morning with George Stephanopoulos, Senator Chuck Schumer, the new Democratic Party head, admitted that the Democrats didn't have an economic message. And that's why they lost the election. Well, how is it that Randy Weingarten did not impose an economic message on the Democratic Party before giving her endorsement to Clinton? How is that? How can that happen in an institution that's supposed to support the middle class? I'll ask you that question.
Well, you're putting me on the spot. I don't mind. Is it irrational? It's, first of all, Brian, you know I'm persona non grata almost everywhere, especially in high-level union circles. When you get people saying that they can't be on your show when you haven't even asked them, it sort of like tells you that you're not welcome in that part of our battle. But But I'll say this again because I've said it over and over and over again. And we're now talking at the micro level, folks, here. And
sure.
Not just Randy Weingartner, but you also Lily, who inherited her position.
Yes.
I think it was, 2 years ago, what have you. And
correct.
Then states and at state level, county level, city level, that leadership group. When the philosophy has shifted to the corporate Democrats, the third way, Clinton, Obama, Democrats that represent the 1%, when that took place, our leadership stopped working really on behalf of the membership.
Sure.
They work more on behalf of the corporate Dems and their MAC agenda that we talk about here all the time. Their messages, and then saying that you look at what a person does to try and figure out what he or she really is all about and where they're coming from, not their words. When you look at the actions and you look at the policies that they have supported, and look at Randy when she came down to New Jersey a few years ago and helped negotiate the union contract between the teachers and Christie.
Chris Christie, right, Governor.
You remember, that was a horrendous contract for the membership.
Yes. Yes.
Look at other areas where she inserted herself. In Detroit, when the teachers voted in a person,
Steve,
I don't want to call his name right now.
Steve Thon, yeah.
Then the board made every effort they could to get rid of him, and they finally did in an illegal process. Randy stepped in. She sent her top leadership down to Detroit to help. Well, first she sort of put them in suspension or something. You remember that?
Yes, that's correct. That's right. That's
so
correct.
So that the National could take over. Like a school closure.
That's
school,
right.
Turnaround. Outside management group comes in. She then even sent her people door to door, knocking on teachers' doors, trying to get them to accept what Randy and company had imposed, and on and on and on. So,
well, that wasn't the first time.
That
wasn't the first time.
No, but Detroit got it for the first time, and it shocked people. But the point is that when you look at what the union, and we're now talking only about public education unions.
Yes, that's right.
You look at what they've done across the country, the individual and collective impact of the various acts, horrendous. But now, let's don't stop there. Let's go back to the macro.
Sure.
Level.
Sure.
Look at the automobile industry. Look at all the other industries where the unions have capitulated. And I know you're going to talk about that later, and I don't want to use your words. But this has been a trend since the 1980s. And I talked about this somewhat extensively. When Reagan came in, of course, like all Republicans, he vows to crush the union. And all the ones before him have vowed. But he actually came in. And the Air Traffic Controllers Union went on strike. Petco went on strike, and he turned around and fired every one of them, putting the nation at risk. And that scared the shit out of unions across the country. And ever since then, union leaderships have been capitulating at the bargaining table ever since. So what
That's
we're
right.
talking about as relates to teachers' union at the national, state, county, city, you're just following what has been going on nationally across the country.
Absolutely.
Fine. Let's move to the failure of the union leadership has allowed the Democratic Party to move to the right.
Absolutely. And let's be very specific, and I want to hone in on this. In 2008, there was a union initiative called Card Check. You remember Card Check?
Explain that to people.
Card Check was a mechanism in which if you were in the private sector and you wanted to start a union, you need only sign a card, okay? And once you get enough people to sign the card, I'm generalizing right now, but this is the general theme. Once you get enough people to sign the card, the NLRB will come in, have an election.
National Labor Board.
Yes, they will come in, have an election, certify the union, recognize it, and therefore you can have a union, be it Verizon or anywhere else in the private sector, wherever your company is. This was a big AFL-CIO, AFT initiative that the unions, okay, in addition to their supporting Obama, they wanted Obama to support and push through Card Check, okay? So lo and behold, we get to 2009. Obama has majority in the House. He has 60 senators, okay? And he does a 180 on Card Check. And Trumka, Weingarten, none of them hold him accountable. They're complaining quietly about the betrayal, but obviously Card Check was going to reverse the declining numbers in union leadership and unionism throughout the nation, which would in turn rebuild the middle class. A valiant idea, but there was no political consequence. And I think this is where the teachers' unions, particularly leadership, have failed. It's like this. If I agree, okay, and we're going to get to fraud and the inducement, your favorite term, in a second. If you agree to cut my hair, okay, and I pay you $20, and we get to the chair and you don't cut my hair, okay, I'm going to walk out and I'm not going to come back to your barbershop. Not only that, I'm going to tell other people not to come back to your barbershop, okay? So what the union has done is they are offering teachers, in particular, a service. You are going to get collective bargaining. You're going to get a contract with rules and regulations to protect you. We're going to advocate for you to have legal representation. This is what you get in exchange for your dues. We're going to endorse school board candidates, etc. And what's supposed to happen, if the union doesn't deliver, they're supposed to run challengers, okay, to the person who promised to support the union initiative, okay? But that's not happening. In other words, when the Democratic Party leadership, okay, gives this wink and an eye, and you said smiling faces in your song right in the intro of the show, to the union, they know there's not going to be a political consequence. It's like, you stupid teachers' unions are going to support the Democratic Party in perpetuity, even though your quality of life is declining every year. And that is what Trump capitalized on. Okay, he's like, these people don't have any principles. They're cowards. They're paying their dues. And you know what? I'm going to get this opening and come in and knock them out. And I think that is where the common sense of teachers really needs to be looked at. And I'm not trying to say that teachers are stupid. They're not. But teachers have been trained, in my view, to depend on the union leadership for their political philosophy, who you're going to vote for, what initiative. And most oftentimes, these are backroom deals that have taken place. And the teachers in their classroom teaching. So you don't have a participatory union. You have an oligarchical union that dictates to the membership instead of the membership dictating to the leadership what they want. So you have a reverse democracy. And if unions are going to survive, that's what's going to have to take place. It's called accountability, okay? And it's called political consequences. And it's also called, bottom line, what do we believe in as teachers? I'll let you respond.
Oh, I didn't know that. You were doing so well. Everything that you said, I have said probably a dozen times or more, and that's part of the reason why I'm persona non grata. But I'm glad you said it, but I'll own it because that's that's true. And I have said that I gave this example. Mm-hmm. Maybe this will summarize everything that you said. Is that most of us, we usually don't grow up in a family where politics and economic policies are discussed on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't grow up in said environment, then we go to school, be it K through 12, and if our teachers are not talking about it, et cetera, then you get into college, and it's not being talked about, taught, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then when you get into the job, you have no knowledge base experience of your own, so that the teacher's union becomes the source of your political awareness and your political activism.
Yes.
I remember as a young kid, my father, and I've said this many, many times, my father couldn't read or write, but he would get the union magazine every week. And when it came time to voting local, state, federal level, the union endorsed candidates, and my mother would do the voting for him, and et cetera, so that he didn't know. I had an opportunity to get some ideas of what was happening because of my household, and then when I got into college, and on and on, so that by the time I'm ready to vote, I can vote as an independent person in terms of doing my own due diligence and making up my own mind, et cetera. And I don't have to depend on the union or the media or anyone else to tell me how I should vote, why I should vote for that person or party, and when. Back to teachers coming in, if you had that experience growing up, you weren't active, you didn't become a student activist, you didn't become a social activist on your own. You don't have that, so you have to rely on your union.
Right.
And that, to me, is can be, and has, in my view, has been shown to be really, really dangerous.
No, I agree. Because what's happened is now, and every, you know, teachers see themselves working harder, more hours, unilateral changes in working conditions, okay? They see this, okay? And getting less and less and less compensation over time. They know this. But what's happened, so now that they become a prisoner to their union, okay? So now what's happened is it's like, man, if I say anything, a lot of these teachers' union bosses do this, if I complain about my union, the union president is going to go to management and make sure my performance review is poor. I've seen it happen a dozen times. If I say anything, I'm going to get a more difficult teaching schedule. You see my point. If I say anything, the union bosses, along with management, will put more difficult students in my classroom. All kinds of ways that teachers who see themselves being attacked want to exert their rights. This is even a deeper issue. So it's that now the union has become the vehicle of your demise. The union itself and the union's lack of principles itself. I think that most teachers, and this is what I think, most teachers, as long as they see their union leadership fighting, even if they lose on a particular issue, as long as they see their union and they believe their union is fighting for them, the teachers will continue to have support in the union. When they see the teachers' union leadership not fighting, they become demoralized. And a demoralized teacher, as you know, starts calling in sick, stops coming to work, and next thing you know, they're not in the profession anymore. You see, and that's the tragedy I'm seeing with increasing numbers. It's, I'm sick of this profession. I don't want to do this anymore. It's not worth it. And then we get to these protests and walkouts. The students I believe middle school, some middle school students, high school, college students, are marching and protesting. And I believe they're doing this is because they have an inherent instinct that their future is bleak. They really understand that, you know what, I'm going to get out of high school or college. I'm not going to get a job. I'm not going to have upward mobility. I sense it, so I'm going to walk out of this school, okay, because I sense the injustice. My biggest problem, we talk about teachers as leaders, the teachers have been experiencing this same sentiment as their students for 20-something-odd years or more, and yet they're not leading the walkouts. They're following the students. This happened in Berkeley this a couple of days ago. The teachers were following the students to Cal Berkeley to protest the election of Donald Trump, okay? And teachers were asking me, are we going to get in trouble for walking out and following the students? Literally. Are they going to write us up for discipline? And I just shook my head. I said, you guys should have walked out first, and they would have followed you. And this is the consciousness. It's the worst thing I've seen. As you know, paperclip rebellion that they've had, I believe that was in Europe, okay, when first thing the Nazis did is they came after the teachers, of course,
World War
for obvious reasons.
World War II. Germany.
Yes. That's right. I think that teachers are going to have to develop a not only intellectual consciousness, but a moral consciousness for the future of their students. And it does not include, frankly, the union. Okay? Notice what I just ran down. The union is a kind of an accent. It's a separate issue than what I'm talking about, fundamentally protecting the future of your students and their viability in the classroom and outside the classroom. Okay? The union is not interested in economic justice, middle-class share of income, tax policy vis-a-vis the rich, tax loopholes, unfair, North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. The unions have no interest at all in actually addressing the policies that are harming their members. And also, which is strange, the teachers' unions in particular, and I've been trying to push this in California, Florida, other places, the teachers' unions should have an alliance with the nurses. They don't. Should have an alliance with the people who work in the ports. Yes, the longshoremen. They don't. They should have an alliance with the firefighters. They don't. They should have an alliance with the police department. They don't. They don't have an alliance of any of these labor groups. Similar socioeconomic strata to actually build their coalitions. And that's not an accident. That is not an accident. Randy Weingarten does not want a multi-layered coalition to hold her accountable. She does not want teachers showing up on the ports, and she doesn't want those port workers showing up at the school boards and vice versa. And that is, I think, where teachers can make a lot of inroads, I believe.
Let me correct myself when I said World War II Germany. The paperclip revolution started in one of the German-occupied countries in Europe, where
yes.
the teachers refused to cooperate with the Germans' demands as it related to possibly going as far as identifying their potential Jewish students.
Yes, that's right.
The curriculum, right. And on and on and on.
Right.
So that's a correction. And then the paperclip group that's here on Facebook that started between a teacher in Detroit and a teacher in, I think, upstate New York, and then grew to where it has members in various parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, jokingly blamed me for this paperclip getting started.
right.
So, that's the one thing. And then, as it relates to what you were saying in terms of coalition building, we had that, and I'm not a labor historian, I'm not a labor specialist. I wish I had Lois Wiener, who has been on the show many, many times, from a professor who lives in New York, even Mark, who I think is a labor historian.
He is, yes, Nason.
Mm-hmm. Who could give you being everyone, more specific detail information on this. But my recollection is that back in the 50s and parts of the 60s, there was attempt to labor unions come together under a bigger umbrella. The AFL-CIO came together, and as a result, they covered almost the entire automobile industry. And so when they spoke on behalf of tens of thousands, millions of workers across the country. And yes, that was a period where they had most of their gains that have been pretty much wiped away now. But that's something that I've been talking about both on the show and talking about as I was traveling across the country, that if you stand as an individual unit, if you stand as an individual by yourself, and I use the symbol of holding up my hand with my fingers spread apart, and I see how easy it is to bend a finger backwards or forwards, what have an individual finger. And that represents the individual. That represents a given school district, a given community. But when you then take those separate fingers, you pull them together, and then you ball up a fist, I said, that's when you start to scare the shit out of the 1%.
Right.
Because you can't peel off a finger. You can't harm the individuals because you now have, instead of having 1,000, you may now have 100,000. You may have 1,000,000. And that's what I think you're saying, that current leadership is not interested in allying with the various middle-class, supposedly middle-class unions, the unions that represent the middle class, because the salaries pay so much that they are part of maybe the lower middle class, but they're middle class and far better off than the working class people are. So, yes, that's if they were to come together, that will impact the influence, the power of individual leadership at individual unions, and yes, they would be more accountable to a wider base rather than seeing that as a positive, seeing it as a negative and as a threat. And yes, you don't have the type of union unions coming across the country or a given state coming together forming this larger coalition that is most desperately needed. That is a problem. That's a micro problem and a macro problem. Brian, I'm pretty sure that we shouldn't even try and go too much further because we only have about 5 minutes left. So let's plan on a part two.
Absolutely.
You mentioned something earlier in terms of something you and I have had many, many, many conversations on, fraud in the inducement.
Yes, absolutely.
And you remember the other concepts I introduce you to?
Well, fraud and inducement comes up the most often, but you also had concepts of legal concepts. We talked about several legal
concepts. Let me go ahead. Okay. We're talking about legal concepts. When you go to law school, you'll learn almost in your first year, and especially your second year, when that's used when you get to the commercial law, that there are various concepts and legal theories upon which precedent, I've explained this in the past, a precedent is a decision that comes out of a given case by maybe a given judge that other judges, usually starting in the local area and maybe then spreading throughout the state and then eventually throughout the country, that local other judges, when they come across a case that are similar, very close to the original case, they then will use that original case or set of cases as a precedent. And by that, the idea is that a lot of what you see coming out of court is based upon precedent. Judges will rule according to earlier cases that have become precedent, like the past
stare decisis,
sort of thing.
Yeah, stare decisis, okay? Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I have, in talking to Brian over the years and the work that he's been doing, I introduced him to three legal concepts that I thought were being totally not recognized and utilized by lawyers who represent individual teachers and who represent districts. And so that if one were to understand those concepts and learn how to use them effectively, they could
have to talk about racketeering in the RICO statutes. We're going to have to get into statewide in California, school district law firms are terminating teachers and employees on false trumped-up charges. School boards are ratifying their termination on these false charges. And in turn, the school district lawyers are making profits hand over hand off of this fraud. So we're talking about it is a racketeering scheme. Racketeering is, as you know, using fraud for personal financial gain. We're going to have to really expose and get into deeper. It'll probably take a whole show to talk about this new market, monopoly market, a school district law firms have created, literally attacking the teachers and creating a new market that didn't exist before. We're going to have to really get deep into this, that the kind of corporate education reform also has gone into school district legal policy. And we're really going to have to really educate teachers on what's going on with this issue.
Okay, we can save that for our second show. We got about 3 minutes left. Let's try and pull this all together in terms of what I think is the value of what we've been talking about to teachers. And here I go. The paradigm: awareness, understanding, emotional engagement, individual and or collective action. Without awareness, the other three most likely will not occur.
Yes.
Awareness is what we have been trying to talk about today. The Trump experience that everyone has experienced.
Sure.
Let's talk about, not you and I, because we don't have the time right now, but what Brian and I are talking about is this is an opportunity to try and work on teachers, parents, and everyone else's awareness, that first critical stage. And then the understanding, and then the emotional engagement. Some of me, of course, a lot of you, if not all of you, are already at the emotional engagement part because you're so traumatized over Trump being going. But this is what we're going to do. That's what we're trying to do on this show. And then, Brian, I'm going to schedule maybe even next week you and I to do a part two on this. So that what we're trying to do, folks, is not only explain to some extent why Trump won, but the role of the unions, the Democrats, in enabling a Trump to win, but also what it has done to individual teachers, individual school districts, communities, students, and et cetera, and how it all came about, how it was enabled by, quote, the smiling faces that we talked about at the very beginning of the show. Brian, thank you. You have been
very
brilliant.
Good, sir.
And then you get an A from me on this.
Appreciate it.
But don't let it go to your head. Next week we'll do it again, and we'll see what you come up with. So you may get an F, but you end up with a C for the series. Not bad. Anyway, thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next week. Have a good one.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.